It's the 50th anniversary of the passing of Eamon de Valera, former Taoiseach, former leader of Fianna Fáil, former president of this country. So we thought it was an ideal time to take a look. Take a look, I suppose, at his legacy 50 years on from his passing in August of 1975. In a moment, we'll be speaking to former TD Eamon O'Queeve, grandson of Eamon de Valera. But first, we're going to hear from a report which was done and shown on RT television in 1975. You'll hear it the first. John A. Murphy, former, no longer with us, of course, God rest him. He was the former professor of history at UCC, University College Cork. And he was in Ennis in County Clare. He was speaking first about Eamon de Valera's legacy, but then speaking to the people of Ennis about what they thought of his legacy in the immediate aftermath of his passing in 1975.
Even not accepting Daniel O'Connell, no Irish leader ever held the political stage so long. Eamon de Valera dominated Irish politics, in or out of office, from the East Clare by-election of 1917 to the years of neutrality and beyond. I wrote these words earlier this year, and here in Ennis, one has an opportunity of testing a historian's assessment against local realities. Across the country in Dublin, solemn scenes of pageantry mark Eamon de Valera's funeral, but here in Ennis, one is much more conscious of the politician underneath the statesman, of the real politic, of the struggle for power.
Well, of course, I mean, we were very young when we didn't know him, but, you know, all belonged to us were de Valera's, and we're still de Valera people. He's one man we admired. We met him on a few occasions in Clare, and he was very wicked, very wicked. A lot of people are very sad over it.
We feel lonesome after him. I was a great man, surely. He was controversial, but he was a good man. He done a lot for the country in his time.
I was sorry for him, sure. He was a marvellous man. He was a great representative, like, internationally. Or anywhere that Irish exiles foregathered, they had a great wish for down there.
But my feelings were. He did a lot of good and a lot of harm. Would like to sum it up that way?
He was one of the best men we ever knew. He was a great statesman, a great man for Ireland altogether.
That's for sure. One of the oldest members of his party is there.
Yes.
Yeah.
How would you sum him up as a man?
The best statesman in the world today. That's what I have to say about him anyway.
Sorry to hear that he's gone?
Oh, extremely sorry. Went up Monday evening to his funeral, all the way up to Dublin. Yeah.
Well, I had the word there for 2 minutes after, because he was the daddy of all of us. Doubt a shadow of a doubt.
Yeah, there you go. That's some people speaking on that programme in 1975 on the occasion of the passing of Eamon de Valera. With me on the line is former Minister, former TD Eamon O'Queeve, who's Eamon de Valera's grandson, of course. Eamon, good morning to you and thanks for joining me in the programme this morning.
Thank you.
How difficult a job, Eamon, is it to assess the legacy? And for you yourself, I suppose, you have to separate out, I suppose, the iconic historical figure and the views of him with your personal relationship with him as a human being, as a grandfather.
Yeah, he was a very kind grandfather. Both my grandparents were, I suppose, what you would hope to have in grandparents. Now, when we were growing up, my father's parents had died before my parents had got married. So the only grandparents we knew were Eamon de Valera and Granny, my grandmother, Sinead de Valera, who was a very strong personality in her own right, and, you know, a very lively person and a person with very strong views.
Yeah, yeah, indeed. And what was he like as a grandfather?
Well, what you'd expect a grandfather to be, kindly, interested in what we were doing, very interested in what we were doing, good fun, a good source of stories of all types. Not all of them very serious. He'd tell you about growing up, funny things that happened to him. He'd even tell you about, you know, things he said out of place. I remember his sight was poor And he told us that inadvertently, not really thinking, he was at the Gaiety Theatre, and he had been informed beforehand that the manager's wife was a fairly good-looking lady. And he said, "They tell me you're very beautiful." He said to her, and didn't think of what he was actually saying, but he said, "You know, I don't see it at all." Now, what he meant was physically, but it was only when the words were out of his mouth he suddenly realised that that was the most terrible thing say to a woman. And he realised immediately, and he told us like that he had done it. So he wasn't the kind of aloof person that people, often portray him to be. And we'd have seen that very much with my mother as well, who had known him right back. My mother was born in 1918 and was very proud of the fact that she had a birth certificate showing that her place of residence and father was Lincoln Prison. But she had a very close relationship with him, and very much what you'd expect of a father-daughter relationship. And it could be quite, they were very close together. But like, she'd have teased him and he'd have teased her and so on in the normal way that parents and daughters do where there's a good, strong bond and relationship.
Yeah. Did you find then, when you were in politics, when you're learning more about, I suppose, the assessments that were made after his death, did you find it hard to reconcile the views on his personality as being, maybe cold or distant or calculating when it came to that side of him and the person that you knew?
Well, I know my mother used to get very irate about this, saying that that wasn't the person that she knew. And it wasn't the person we knew either. And we had a great relationship with them. And, a little story. When I was coming down to work, now, remember, I was 25 years of age when he died. So I actually was working in the Dry's Country as the local co-op manager. But I remember Christmas, before I came down, which was Christmas of 1973, we went out to visit him in Linden, and he asked me had I fixed up the lodgings, because he knew I hadn't the previous visit I had paid to him. So he was interested in day-to-day things of your life and was very practical about them. But he also had some great stories about this area that I live in now, because it was, both my grandmother and himself had spent some time in Turmikide. He'd have fun of stories that were, and often the laugh was on himself, and he thought they were really, really funny, and they were really, really funny.
So he had a self-deprecating side to himself.
Oh yeah, definitely. And there was one story he had about they were coming to a place called Chanafarchain, and there was a shebeen in the area, and everybody knew it was a shebeen, but when they arrived at the shebeen this day, the companion and themselves, they went in, and the banditti denied that there was any drink in the house. And the guy that was with them called him outside and said, "Look, I know that you have a shebeen, and I know you serve drink." She says, "Do you expect me to serve drink?" And she pointed in the door at De Valera, who was a big, tall man, and said, "Do you see that man there, and him a policeman?" So so they didn't get any drink.
My God, she had no idea. So, Eamon, when you look now at I suppose the assessment, and let me ask you your observations of how you think the assessments of him as a political leader have changed, even over the last 20 years. I know a number of biographies have been written recently with new information that's come to light. And we're talking about how hard it is to separate, I suppose, your views of him as a person and the iconic Irish historical political figure. But how difficult it is to get an assessment of the man and his contribution, given what he went through, given what country went through, the bitterness of the Civil War, post-Civil War politics. He was a hate figure on one side. He was almost a deity on the other. All of that. It's hard to separate the I suppose, controversy from the political figure, is it?
Well, it was inevitable in a life so long and so involved that there'd be a certain amount of controversy. And people have different views on every aspect of him. But the one thing I look at and say to myself as a practicing politician, more than as a grandson, here was somebody who from the early 30s on commanded high 40s and 50% of the poll kept the party with him. And that's a very difficult thing to do. He wasn't operating as an individual just on his own. He had to bring his colleagues with him, and they were strong-willed colleagues. I mean, the idea that McEntee and Sean Lamass and Frank Aiken and Boland, were wilting, Fowles, and would just do what he said, I think that's a myth.
Yeah,
and he kept his parliamentary party with him. He had kept his whole wider party with him. Any politician today that was getting 49 or 50% would be lauded as a genius to do it over a few years or over a few elections. But he did it consistently because, interestingly enough, in 1933, he got an overall majority. And in his last election in 1957, he got an overall majority. So people forget that in the mix of all of this, of being in power, you had to retain power and you had to retain the people with you. And you had to retain the people with you as the people were. So looking at De Valera, for example, on various issues, without actually looking at the society in which he operated and the constraints that any society puts on a politician today, just as much as it puts it on politicians today in a different ways, different mores. But similarly, he was working within those constraints as well. So all I'd say is I'd love to have the formula, because it was a magic formula in terms of electoral performance. And in the end of the day, as we all know in politics, you can shout all you want. But, and again, you see, I'd have an appreciation of this, having been in government for a long time and served in cabinet for a long time. In fact, a very long time in the terms of modern people serving in cabinet.
Yes.
I was there from 2002 to 2011. The reality is that you can do things when you're in power. You can make decisions. And sometimes you have to make hard and controversial decisions. But there's no point always shouting from the sidelines. And of course, most politicians would aspire to be in power, not for personal glorification, but to do the job the way they think it should be done, and let the people judge.
And that is part of it.
On that measure. Now the other thing is, I mean, he did a lot of, again, I look at somebody who worked fairly hard in the politics. He had set up the Irish Press, and the Irish Press was key to his success, and the success of Fianna Fáil over many years, and. He had set that up, and he kept an eye on that. He was the leader of his party. He was Taoiseach of the country. So I often wonder, and then he did a lot of small stuff that people wouldn't be aware of, but I would become aware of in various ways. So I sometimes stand amazed personally, because I've been in the position of doing things and working hard in politics, of how much he got through in a day.
Yeah. How much energy he had and how much he developed. There's an assessment of him. It's in the Irish Times today, Eamon, and it comes from, this is Dermot Ferriter is writing about his legacy. But in a part of it, he says David Gray, who was the US diplomat in Dublin in 1940. Now, Gray detested Eamon de Valera. He was very frustrated by him. But he actually told US President Franklin D. Roosevelt that Dave is probably the most adroit politician in Europe. He honestly believes all he does is good for the country. He's the qualities of a martyr, a fanatic, and a Machiavelli. Nobody can outwit him, frighten him, or brandish him. What do you make of that assessment?
Well, the one part I take from my grandmother's testimony, my grandmother was a very interesting person and had her own views. She was very, very Republican. Very anti-treaty, but she had her own views, but she also could keep personal relationships and see the good in people who differed from her politically. But she used to always say that in the espionage, in that kind of work that had to be done in the War of Independence, that Collins was the bravest of them all. He was the most fearless of them all. That in a battle, that Carl Brew was the bravest, but that in a negotiation, De Valera was the bravest. Now, that was her assessment, and I think it's an interesting assessment. In other words, saying these were wonderful people, but they were different. And I think that is something and they had different strengths. But certainly when it came to negotiation, he'd keep talking, he'd keep negotiating, but he was, they say, according to all the books, that he was hard enough to shift.
Yeah. Yeah, he certainly was. In the 1930s, when there was a shift to Europe, in Europe to authoritarianism, you know, he did remain a solid believer in democracy. And I suppose the constitution reflects that commitment, and Ireland managed to keep out of that slide to the right.
Yes, and Fianna Fáil represents that commitment, because Fianna Fáil, you know, there's always the kind of picture today of this character being hugely dominant, and what he said was law. I actually think, from my experience of him, that he was really listening to the people on the ground all the time. He had contacts all over the country, and he travelled quite a bit around the country, and that he really believed in the concept that he had. He had an interesting relationship with Daniel O'Connell, in that he saw quite a bit of good in Daniel O'Connell, particularly in the mass movement, and a great respect for O'Connell. He wouldn't have agreed with everything. My grandmother was less praiseworthy of Daniel O'Connell, and it was the only thing that we knew they disagreed on. But
he even said the assessment of him had changed, like when he was young and growing up in the Republican movement or younger, they would have seen O'Connell as weak. He should have kept going with the mass meetings. He capitulated. But then he grew to a better understanding of him as he got older, and he saw the realities of politics.
And I think it's fair to say that Fianna Fáil, this idea of organising every parish of Ireland behind his movement, and having a very strong grassroots, and a very, in the old days, it's much less that way now. In the old days, the local organisation was boss, and they picked the candidates, and they ran their own organisation, and there was very little headquarters input from day to day in what they did. And there was a great evolution of power down to the people. So, as well as the constitution being a bulwark, of democracy, and it is a very strong bulwark. And the measure I have of the real truth about the constitution are looking at the result of referenda over the years. And there have been successful referendum, there have been ones that have failed. But often in the debate on the on the constitution, the real complexities of it and the strong commitment to democracy come out. And one thing about the constitution is that the idea of the presidency, which is quite being talked about quite at the moment, the idea of it is that you have a safeguard against any government or any Oireachtas that got notions about itself and started doing what I think we see in other countries at the moment, a slide towards autocracy.
Which
there was a strong moral force, not to be used every day, but there in the background.
But in place.
To keep in place and to keep sure, there's a great expression in the Irish language of the affirmation, to be a support, and to be a shelter for the constitution. And this idea that there was somebody there that would, if a government were getting out of hand, be able to call things to order by moral force. And he really believed strongly in moral force, not by an army, not by any political force, but by moral force, muster the people to defend the basic right of the constitution and the inviolability of the right of the people only to decide what goes into that constitution and what comes out of
it. What comes out of it, Eamon, how do you view, just and finally on this element of his legacy, his economic legacy? It's amazing we're talking about tariffs today in a way we haven't really for decades across the world. Ireland is a protectionist state. The economic war, people felt economically and culturally, to an extent, we were a suffocating place in the 1950s, and a lot of blame is laid at his door for that. Is that unfair, or does he take some of the blame?
You know, it's interesting. Sean Lamass, a really, really capable politician, was Minister of Industry and Commerce, except for during the war when he became Minister of Supplies. Now, first of all, the 30s was a time of depression. And what they did was distribute the income, they distributed land, they did all sorts of things. I remember getting taken to task by my father-in-law and it was the only time he took me to task in anything, when I had the temerity one day to say, well, what did Fianna Fáil ever do? He was a small farmer in the West. And he explained how life improved in the 30s, despite the fact that it wasn't the greatest time of world economy. Now, the second thing is, in the 30s, well, first of all, it was following on the Griffith Sinn Féin policy, but in the 30s, they built up industries, they set up the sugar company, they set up all sorts of businesses, private businesses as well. And doing it behind tariff walls, I think the analogy I always give on that is, it's like a plant. When you sow them in the spring and the frost is still around, you put the polythene around, and then when they get strong, they can fight without the polythene and they can survive and grow and thrive. Now, the 30s, if they hadn't done so much on self-sufficiency, and in certain ways they didn't do enough, for example, it was only at the beginning of the war they set up a merchant navy to make us secure. We wouldn't have survived the way we did throughout the war. Now, the interesting thing is, you can see a debate, and there was a big debate, and Sean Lamass was key to this debate, in the post-war period. And there was two things that they looked at. One was getting foreign industry in, and the other one was imposing inspectors into the companies to increase the efficiencies of the companies. So they had started looking at all of this. And by 57, the first program of economic expansion. Now, what's often overlooked, maybe justifiably, maybe not, that the first program of of economic expansion came in the 57 to 59 period, and De Valera was still Taoiseach and he acquiesced to this. And that was the one that led to the bringing in of foreign industry. So things had evolved, but the world had evolved and life had changed in that time. Now, on the other hand, if we now move forward to 2025, the necessity for us to start getting and harnessing energy sources of our own in a world that's geopolitical world that's very unstable. We cannot rely on Russian gas and by extension on the gas shock in Europe anymore. And that means that being over-dependent on bringing in fossil fuels from anywhere in the world, including Britain, our next-door neighbour, if they come under pressure, because it's a domino effect. In the time that we developed our renewable industries and went back to the idea of self-sufficiency in energy, because if somebody switches off the lights, everyone would start shouting and saying, why didn't you put up?
Why didn't we do this? Why didn't we do that?
Yeah. And why didn't you become self-sufficient? And so we have to keep rolling with the tide, and you have to judge each policy as a politician within the context of the current time.
Yeah. Eamon, your grandfather got great support from people around him and very strong connections here in Kerry. I know that you were you unveiled a plaque in 2016 to Kathleen O'Connell in Caherdaniel. She was a key support to him right throughout his career, the revolutionary period and otherwise. And I know Marie O'Kelly from South Kerry as well.
Yeah, Marie O'Kelly was from South Kerry, and she was a niece of Kathleen O'Connell. And sometimes that's overlooked. I can't remember Kathleen O'Connell in that. In those years, he was either leader of the opposition, or Taoiseach, and she would have been working with him in the office. When Mary O'Kelly was a secretary, he became president, and I got to know Mary O'Kelly very, very well. Myself personally, as we all did, we all knew, all the grandchildren and all the family knew Mary O'Kelly well. And long after she retired from work, I used to bring her to Fianna Fáil or dishes and so on. And she even offered to do some typing for me one time when I was looking for somebody to type in Irish, because I couldn't get anybody in Leinster House to do it. So there was a very close bond between him and all of the staff. I mean, an incredibly close bond with Mary O'Kelly, who had been so good to him over the years. And remember, from 1951 on, and people forget this, even when he was Taoiseach, the sight had failed as much as it ever failed. He had peripheral vision, and therefore stuff had to be read to him. He had a phenomenal memory, and dealing with, worked up in Áras an Uachtaráin, and as a kind of memento, my grandmother had given that, and I think other things as well, to this person as a member of staff. So there was, if you look at his long life, Maurice Moynihan, who eventually did a compilation after his death, of all the speeches and statements he had made, or the major ones he made. Maurice Moynihan had been a civil servant in the Free State days, pre-1932, at the time the Cumann na Gael were in government, and he became his private secretary and became a very, very loyal aide to De Valera, became government secretary later on and so on, and a trusted lieutenant. So one thing that was really an example to us was the work relations he had with all those who worked with him.
Indeed.
That was an example, again an example to the likes of me who followed into politics
into politics
at a later time.
You have to bring people with you, that's for sure. Mary Devan Wilson says, give my best to Eamon O'Queeve. That's Mary Devan Wilson from Dingle, Eamon. And another listener, you mentioned the presidency. Someone wants to know, will Eamon be putting his name forward as a Fianna Fáil president candidate? You've no shortages of people putting their names forward these days, Eamon, anyway.
No shortage of people putting their name forward, but... you know, we'll see about that, but I don't think so.
Okay, well, Eamon, look, thanks very much for taking time to talk to us and give us your perspective and your insight, I suppose, in the unique place you have in terms of him as a man and as a politician 50 years on from his passing.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Gurmila Mahagat.
That's Eamon O'Queeve there, former minister, former TD for Fianna Fáil and grandson of Eamon De Valera, talking about the man, the human being, the grandfather, the father, and the politician, the Taoiseach and the president. If you have your own view and your perspective on Eamon De Valera 50 years on from his passing, 29th of August 1975, we'd love to hear from you on the programme this morning.